Healed,
she cried in a voice that was filled with a strange and terrible triumph.
Healed. My son has healed me. His work is great upon the earth.
He tried to protest, to tell her that he didn't want to do great works, or heal, or speak in tongues, to divine the future, or find those things that had been lost. He tried to tell her, but his tongue wouldn't obey the command of his brain. Then she was past him, striding off down the cobbled street, her posture cringing and servile, but somehow arrogant at the same time. Her voice belled like a clarion.
Saved! Savior! Saved! Savior!
And to his horror he saw that there had been thousands of others behind her, maybe millions, all of them maimed or deformed or in terror. The stout lady reporter was there, needing to know who the Democrats would nominate for the presidency in 1976. There was a death-eyed farmer in biballs with a picture of his son, a smiling young man in Air Force blues who had been reported MIA over Hanoi in 1972. He needed to know if his son was dead or alive. A young woman who looked like Sarah, with tears on her smooth cheeks, holding up a baby with a hydrocephalic head on which blue veins were traced like runes of doom. An old man with his fingers turned into clubs by arthritis. Others. They stretched for miles. They would wait patiently. They would kill him with their mute, bludgeoning need. Saved, his mother's voice carried back imperatively. Savior, saved, saved. He tried to tell them that he could neither heal nor save, but before he could open his mouth to make the denial, the first had laid hands on him and was shaking him. The shaking was real enough. It was Wyzak's hand on his arm. Bright orange light filled the car, turning the interior as bright as day. It was nightmare light, turning Sam's kind face into the face of a hobgoblin. For a moment, he thought the nightmare was still going on, and then he saw the light was coming from parking lot lamps. They had changed those too, apparently, while he was in his coma. From hard white to a weird orange that lay on the skin like paint.
Where are we? He asked thickly.
The hospital, Sam said. Cumberland General.
Oh, all right.
He sat up. The dream seemed to slide off him in fragments, still littering the floor of his mind like something broken and not yet swept up. Are you ready to go in?
Yes, Johnny said.
They crossed the parking lot amid the soft creak of summer crickets in the woods. Fireflies stitched through the darkness. The image of his mother was very much on him, but not so much that he was unable to enjoy the soft, and fragrant smell of the night, and with feel of the faint breeze against his skin. There was time to enjoy the health of the night and the feeling of health coming inside him. In the context of why he was here, the thought seemed almost obscene, but only almost, and it wouldn't go away. 2. Herb came down the hallway to meet them. And Johnny saw that his father was wearing old pants, shoes with no socks, and his pajama shirt. It told Johnny a lot about the suddenness with which it had come. It told him more than he wanted to know. Son, he said. He looked smaller somehow. He tried to say more and couldn't. Johnny hugged him and Herb burst into tears. He sobbed against Johnny's shirt.
Daddy, he said. That's all right, Daddy. That's all right.
His father put his arms on Johnny's shoulders and wept. Wyzak turned away and began to inspect the pictures on the walls, in different watercolors by local artists. Herb began to recover himself. He swiped his arm across his eyes and said, "Look at me, still in my PJ top. I had time to change before the ambulance came. I guess I never thought of it. Must be getting senile."
No, you're not.
Well, he shrugged. Your doctor friend brought you down? That was nice of you, Dr. Wyzak. Sam shrugged. It was nothing. Johnny and his father walked toward the small waiting room and sat down.
Daddy, is she?
She's sinking, Herb said. He seemed calmer now,
conscious but sinking. She's been asking for you, Johnny. I think she's been holding on for you.
My fault, Johnny said. All this is my...
The pain in his ears startled him, and he stared at his father, astonished. Herb had seized his ear and twisted it firmly. So much for the role reversal of having his father cry in his arms. The old twist-the-ear trick had been a punishment Herb had reserved for the gravest of errors. Johnny couldn't remember having his ear twisted since he was 13 and had gotten fooling around with their old Rambler. He had inadvertently pushed in the clutch, and the old car had rumbled silently downhill to crash into their back shed.
"Don't you ever say that," Herb said.
"Geez, Dad."
Herb let go, a little smile lurking just below the corners of his mouth.
"Forgot all about the old twist the air, huh? Probably thought I had too. No such luck, Johnny."
Johnny stared at his father, still dumbfounded. "Don't you ever blame yourself."
"But she was watching that damned..."
"News, yes. She was ecstatic. She was thrilled. Then she was on the floor, her poor old mouth opening and closing like she was a fish out of water." Herb leaned closer to his son. "The doctor won't come right out and tell me, but he asked me about heroic measures. I told him none of that stuff. She committed her own kind of sin, Johnny. She presumed to know the mind of God. So don't you ever blame yourself for her mistake."
Fresh tears glistened in his eyes. His voice roughened.
"God knows I spent my life loving her, and it got hard in the late going. Maybe this is just the best thing."
"Can I see her?"
"Yes, she's at the end of the hall, room 35. They're expecting you, and so is she. Just one thing, Johnny. Agree with anything and everything she might say. Don't let her die thinking it was all for nothing."
"No," he paused. "Are you coming with me?"
"Not now. Maybe later." Johnny nodded and walked up the hall. The lights were turned down low for the nighttime. The brief moment in the soft, kind summer night seemed far away now, but his nightmare in the car seemed very close. Room 35, Vera Helen Smith, the little card on the door read. Had he known her middle name was Helen? It seemed he must have, although he couldn't remember. But he could remember other things. Her bringing him an ice cream bar wrapped in her handkerchief one bright summer day at Old Orchard Beach, smiling and gay. He and his mother and father playing rummy for matches. Later, after the religion business began to deepen its hold on her, she wouldn't have cards in the house, not even to play cribbage with. He remembered the day the bee had stung him, and he ran to her, bawling his head off, and she had kissed the swelling and pulled out the stinger with tweezers, and then had wrapped the wound in a strip of cloth that had been dipped in baking soda. He pushed the door open and went in. She was a vague hump in the bed, and Johnny thought,
"That's what I looked like."
A nurse was taking her pulse. She turned when the door opened, and the dim hall lights flashed on her spectacles.
"Are you Mrs. Smith's son?"
"Yes."
"Johnny..."
Her voice rose from the hump in the bed, dry and hollow, rattling with death as a few pebbles will rattle in an empty gourd. The voice, God help him, made his skin crawl. He moved closer. Her face was twisted into a snarling mask on the left-hand side. The hand on the counterpane was a claw.
"Stroke," he thought. "What the old people call a shock. Yes, that's better. That's what she looks like. But she's had a bad shock."
"Is that you, John?"
"It's me, Ma."
"Johnny, is that you?"
"Yes, Ma." He came closer yet and forced himself to take the bony claw.
"I want my Johnny,"
she said querulously. The nurse shot him a pitying look, and he found himself wanting to smash his fist through it. "Would you leave us alone?" he asked.
"I really shouldn't, well..." "Come on, she's my mother, and I want some time alone with her," Johnny said. "What about it?"
"Well, bring me my juice, Dad," his mother cried hoarsely. "Feel like I could drink a quart."
"Would you get out of here?" he cried at the nurse.
He was filled with a terrible sorrow, of which he could not even find the focus. It seemed like a whirlpool going down into darkness. The nurse left. Ma, he said, sitting beside her. That weird feeling of doubled time, of reversal, would not leave him. How many times had she sat over his bed like this, perhaps holding his dry hand and talking to him? He recalled the timeless period when the room had seemed so close to him, seen through a gauzy placental membrane, his mother's face bending over him, thundering senseless sounds slowly into his upturned face. Ma, he said again, and kissed the hook that had replaced her hand.
Give me those nails. I can do that, she said.
Her left eye seemed frozen in its orbit. The other rolled wildly. It was the eye of a gut-shot horse.
I want Johnny.
Ma, I'm here.
Johnny, Johnny, Johnny!
Ma, he said, afraid the nurse would come back.
You.
She broke off and her head turned toward him a little.
Bend over here where I can see, she whispered.
He did as she asked.
You came, she said. Thank you. Thank you.
Tears began to ooze from the good eye. The bad one, the one on the side of her face that had been frozen by the shock, stared indifferently upward. Sure I came.
I saw you, she whispered. What a power God has given you, Johnny. Didn't I tell you? Didn't I say it was so?
Yes, you did.
He has a job for you, she said. Don't run from him, Johnny. Don't hide away in a cave like Elijah, or make him send a big fish to swallow you up. Don't do that, John.
No, I won't. He held her claw hand. His head throbbed.
Not the potter, but the potter's clay, John. Remember.
All right.
Remember that,
she said stridently, and he thought,
she's going back into nonsense land.
But she didn't. At least she went no further into nonsense land than she had been since he came out of his coma.
Heed the still, small voice when it comes, she said.
Yes, Ma,
I will.
Her head turned a tiny bit on the pillow and...
Was she smiling? You think I'm crazy, I guess.
She twisted her head a little more so she could look directly at him.
But that doesn't matter. You'll know the voice when it comes. It'll tell you what to do. It told Jeremiah and Daniel and Amos and Abraham. It'll come to you. It'll tell you. And when it does, Johnny, do your duty.
Okay, Ma.
What a power,
she murmured. Her voice was growing furry and indistinct.
What a power God has given you. I knew. I always knew.
Her voice trailed off. The good eye closed. The other stared blankly forward. Johnny sat with her another 5 minutes, then got up to leave. His hand was on the doorknob, and he was easing the door open when her dry, rattling voice came again, chilling him with its implacable, positive command.
Do your duty, John.
Yes, Ma. It was the last time he ever spoke to her. She died at 8:05 on the morning of August 20th. Somewhere north of them, Walt and Sarah Hazlitt were having a discussion about Johnny that was almost an argument. And somewhere south of them, Greg Stilson was cutting himself some prime asshole. Chapter 13. 1.
You don't understand, Greg Stilson said in a voice of utter, reasonable patience to the kid sitting in the lounge at the back of the Ridgeway police station. The kid, shirtless, was tilted back in a padded folding chair and drinking a bottle of Pepsi. He was smiling indulgently at Greg Stilson, not understanding that twice was all Greg Stilson ever repeated himself. Understanding that there was one prime asshole in the room, but not yet understanding who it was. That realization would have to be brought home to him, forcibly if necessary. Outside, the late August morning was bright and warm. Birds sang in the trees, and Greg felt his destiny was closer than ever. That was why he would be careful with this prime asshole. This was no long-haired bike freak with a bad case of bow legs and BO. This kid was a college boy. His hair was moderately long, but squeaky clean, and he was George Harvey's nephew. Not that George cared for him much. George had fought his way across Germany in 1945, and he had two words for those long-haired freaks, and those two words were not happy birthday. But he was blood, and George was a man to be reckoned with on the town council.
"See what you can do with him," George had told Greg when Greg informed him that Chief Wiggins had arrested his sister's kid. But his eyes said, "Don't hurt him. He's blood." The kid was looking at Greg with lazy contempt.
"I understand," he said. "Your deputy dog took my shirt, and I want it back. And you better understand something. If I don't get it back, I'm going to have the American Civil Liberties Union down on your red neck." Greg got up, went to the steel-gray file cabinet opposite the soda machine, pulled out his key ring, selected a key, and opened the cabinet. From atop a pile of accident and traffic forms, he took a red t-shirt. He spread it open so the legend on it was clear. "Baby, let's fuck."
"You were wearing this," Greg said in that same mild voice. "On the street."
The kid rocked on the back legs of his chair and swigged some more Pepsi. The little indulgent smile playing around his mouth, almost a sneer, did not change.
"That's right," he said, "and I want it back. It's my property."
Greg's head began to ache. This smartass didn't realize how easy it would be. The room was soundproofed, and there had been times when that soundproofing had muffled screams. No, he didn't realize. He didn't understand. "But keep your hand on it. Don't go overboard. Don't upset the apple cart." Easy to think, usually easy to do, but sometimes his temper got out of hand. Greg reached into his pocket and pulled out his Bic lighter.
"So you just go tell your Gestapo chief and my fascist uncle that the First Amendment..."
He paused, eyes widening a little.
"What are you..."
Hey! Taking no notice and at least outwardly calm, Greg struck a light. The Bic's gas flame vroomed upward, and Greg lit the kid's t-shirt on fire. It burned quite well, actually. The front legs of the kid's chair came down with a bang, and he leaped toward Greg with his bottle of Pepsi still in his hand. The self-satisfied little smirk was gone, replaced with a look of wide-eyed shock and surprise, and the anger of a spoiled brat who has had everything his own way for too long.
No one ever called him runt, Greg Stilson thought, and his headache worsened. Oh, he was going to have to be careful.
"Give me that," the kid shouted. Greg was holding the shirt out, pinched together in two fingers at the neck, ready to drop it when it got too hot. "Give me that, you asshole! That's mine! That's..." Greg planted his hand in the middle of the kid's bare chest and shoved him as hard as he could, which was hard indeed. The kid went flying across the room, the anger dissolving into total shock, and at last, what Greg needed to see, fear. He dropped the shirt on the tile floor, picked up the kid's Pepsi, and poured what was left in the bottle onto the smoldering t-shirt. It hissed balefully. The kid was getting up slowly, his back pressed against the wall. Greg caught his eyes with his own. The kid's eyes were brown and very, very wide.
"We're going to reach an understanding," Greg said, and the words seemed distant to him, behind the sick thud in his head. "We're going to have a little seminar right here in this back room about just who's the asshole. You got my meaning? We're going to reach some conclusions. Isn't that what you college boys like to do, reach conclusions?"
The kid drew breath in hitches. He wet his lips, seemed about to speak, and then yelled,
"Help!"
"Yeah, you need help, all right," Greg said. "I'm going to give you some, too."
"You're crazy," George Harvey's nephew said, and then yelled again louder, Help! I may be, Greg said, sure. But what we got to find out, Sonny, is who the prime asshole is, see what I mean? He looked down at the Pepsi bottle in his hand, and suddenly he swung it savagely against the corner of the steel cabinet. It shattered, and when the kid saw the scatter of glass on the floor and the jagged neck in Greg's hand pointing toward him, he screamed. The crotch of his jeans, faded almost white, suddenly darkened. His face went the color of old parchment, and as Greg walked toward him, gritting glass under the work boots he wore summer and winter, he cringed against the wall.
When I go out on the street, I wear a white shirt, Greg said.
He was grinning, showing white teeth.
Sometimes a tie. When you go out on the street, you wear some rag with a filthy saying on it. So who's the asshole, kiddo?
George Harvey's nephew whined something. His bulging eyes never left the spears of glass jutting from the bottleneck in Greg's hand.
I'm standing here high and dry, Greg said, coming a little closer. And you got piss running down both legs into your shoes, so who's the asshole?
He began to jab the bottleneck lightly toward the kid's bare and sweaty midriff, and George Harvey's nephew began to cry. This was the sort of kid that was tearing the country in two, Greg thought. The thick whine of fury buzzed and coursed in his head. Stinking yellow, low-belly crybaby assholes like this.
Ah, but don't hurt him. Don't kick over the apple cart.
I sound like a human being, Greg said. And you sound like a pig in a grease pit, boy, so who's the asshole?
He jabbed with the bottle again. One of the jagged glass points dimpled the kid's skin just below the right nipple and brought a tiny bead of blood. The kid howled.
I'm talking to you, Greg said. You better answer up, same as you'd answer up one of your professors. Who's the asshole?
The kid sniveled but made no coherent sound.
You answer up if you want to pass this exam, Greg said. I'll let your guts loose all over this floor, boy.
And in that instant, he meant it. He couldn't look directly at this welling drop of blood. It would send him crazy if he did. George Harvey's nephew or not.
Who's the asshole?
Me,
the kid said, and began to sob like a small child afraid of the boogeyman, the Alamagusalem that waits behind the closet door in the dead hours of the night. Greg smiled. The headache thumped and flared.
Well, that's pretty good, you know. That's a start. But it's not good enough. I want you to say, I'm an asshole.
I'm an asshole, the kid said, still sobbing. Snot flowed from his nose and hung there in a runner. He wiped it away with the back of his hand.
Now I want you to say, I'm a prime asshole.
I'm a prime asshole.
Now you just say one more thing, and maybe we can be done here. You say, thank you for burning up that dirty shirt, Mayor Stilson.
The kid was eager now. The kid saw his way clear. Thank you for burning up that dirty shirt. In a flash, Greg ran one of the jagged points from left to right across the kid's soft belly, bringing a line of blood. He barely broke the skin, but the kid howled as if all the devils of hell were behind him.
You forgot to say Mayor Stilson, Greg said, and just like that, it broke.
The headache gave one more massive beat right between his eyes and was gone. He looked down stupidly at the bottleneck in his hand and could barely remember how it had gotten there.
Stupid damn thing. He'd almost thrown everything away over one numbnuts kid.
Mayor Stilson, the kid was screaming. His terror was perfect and complete.
Mayor Stilson, Mayor Stilson, Mayor Stilson.
That's good, Greg said.
Son, Mayor Stilson, Mayor Stilson, Mayor.
Greg whacked him hard across the face, and the kid wrapped his head on the wall. He fell silent, his eyes wide and blank. Greg stepped very close to him. He reached out. He closed one hand around each of the kid's ears. He pulled the kid's face forward until their noses were touching. Their eyes were less than half an inch apart.
Now your uncle is a power in this town, he said softly,
holding the kid's ears like handles. The kid's eyes were huge and brown and swimming,
I'm a power, too. Coming to be one. But I ain't no George Harvey. He was born here, raised here, everything. And if you was to tell your uncle what went on in here, he might take a notion to finish me in Ridgeway.
The kid's lips were twitching in a nearly soundless blubber. Greg shook the boy's head slowly back and forth by the ears, banging their noses together.
He might not. He was pretty damn mad about that shirt. But he might. Blood ties are strong ties.
So you think about this, son. If you was to tell your uncle what went on here, and your uncle squeezed me out, I guess I would come along and kill you. Do you believe that?
Yeah,
the kid whispered. His cheeks were wet, gleaming.
Yes, sir, Mayor Stilson.
Yes, sir,
Mayor Stilson. Greg let go of his ears.
Yeah, he said, I'd kill you. But first I'd tell anybody that'd listen about how you pissed yourself and stood there crying with snot running out of your nose.
He turned and walked away quickly, as if the kid smelled bad, and went to the cabinet again. He got a box of Band-Aids from one of the shelves and tossed them across to the kid, who flinched back and fumbled them. He hastened to pick them up off the floor, as if Stilson might attack him again for missing. Greg pointed.
Bathroom over there. You clean yourself up. I'm going to leave you a Ridgeway Pal sweatshirt. I want it mailed back, clean, no bloodstains, you understand?
Yes, the kid whispered.
Sir! Stilson screamed at him. Sir, sir, sir! Can't you remember that?
Sir, the kid moaned. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
They don't teach you kids respect for nothing, Greg said. Not for nothing.
The headache was trying to come back. He took several deep breaths and quelled it, but his stomach felt miserably upset.
Okay, that's the end. I just want to offer you one good piece of advice. Don't you make the mistake of getting back to your damn college this fall or whenever and start thinking this was some way it wasn't. Don't you try to kid yourself about Greg Stilson. Best forgotten kid. By you, me, and George. Working this around in your mind until you think you could have another swing at it would be the worst mistake of your life. Maybe the last.
With that, Greg left, taking one last contemptuous look at the kid standing there, his chest and belly caked with a few minor smears of dried blood, his eyes wide, his lips trembling. He looked like an overgrown 10-year-old who has struck out in the Little League playoffs. Greg made a mental bet with himself that he would never see or hear from this particular kid again, and it was a bet he won. Later that week, George Harvey stopped by the barber shop where Greg was getting a shave and thanked him for talking some sense into his nephew.
You're good with these kids, Greg, he said. I don't know. They seem to respect you.
Greg told him not to mention it. 2. While Greg Stilson was burning a shirt with an obscene saying on it in New Hampshire, Walt and Sarah Hazlitt were having a late breakfast in Bangor, Maine. Walt had the paper. He put his coffee cup down with a clink and said, "Your old boyfriend made the paper, Sarah." Sarah was feeding Denny. She was in her bathrobe, her hair something of a mess, her eyes still only about a quarter open. 80% of her mind was still asleep. There had been a party last night. The guest of honor had been Harrison Fisher, who had been New Hampshire's 3rd District Congressman since dinosaurs walked the earth, and a sure candidate for re-election next year. It had been politic for her and Walt to go. Politic. That was a word that Walt used a lot lately. He had had lots more to drink than she had, and this morning he was dressed and apparently chipper while she felt buried in a pile of sludge. It wasn't fair.
Blue, Denny remarked, and spat back a mouthful of mixed fruit.
That's not nice, Sarah said to Denny. To Walt, are you talking about Johnny Smith?
The one and only.
She got up and came around to Walt's side of the table.
He's all right, isn't he?
Feeling good and kicking up Dickens by the sound of this, Walt said dryly. She had a hazy idea that it might be related to what had happened to her when she went to see Johnny. But the size of the headline shocked her. Reawakened coma patient demonstrates psychic ability at dramatic news conference. The story was under David Bright's byline. The accompanying photo showed Johnny, still looking thin, and in the unsparing glare of the flash, pitifully confused, standing over the sprawled body of a man the caption identified as Roger Dussault, a reporter for the Lewiston paper. Reporter faints after revelation, the caption read. Sarah sank down into the chair next to Walt and began to read the article. This did not please Denny, who began to pound on the tray of his high chair for his morning egg. I believe you're being summoned, Walt said.
Would you feed him, honey? He eats better for you anyway.
Story continued, page 9, column 3. She folded the paper open to page 9. Flattery will get you everywhere, Walt said agreeably. He slipped off his sports coat and put on her apron. Here it comes, Guy, he said, and began feeding Denny his egg. When she had finished the story, Sarah went back and read it again. Her eyes were drawn again and again to the picture, to Johnny's confused, horror-struck face. The people loosely grouped around the prone Dussault were looking at Johnny with an expression close to fear. She could understand that. She remembered kissing him, and the strange, preoccupied look that had slipped over his face. And when he told her where to find the lost wedding ring, she had been afraid.
But Sarah, what you were afraid of wasn't quite the same thing, was it?
Just a little more, big boy, Walt was saying, as if from 1,000 miles away. Sarah looked up at them, sitting together in a bar of moat-dusted sunlight, her apron flapping between Walt's knees, and she was suddenly afraid again. She saw the ring sinking to the bottom of the toilet bowl, turning over and over. She heard the small clink as it struck the porcelain. She thought of Halloween masks, of the kid saying, I love to see this guy take a beating. She thought of promises made and never kept, and her eyes went to this thin newsprint face, looking out at her with such haggard, wretched surprise. Gimmick, anyway, Walt said, hanging up her apron. He'd gotten Denny to eat the egg, every bit of it, and now their son and heir was sucking contentedly away at a juice bottle. Huh? Sarah looked up as he came over to her. I said that for a man who must have almost $500,000 worth of hospital bills outstanding, it's a hell of a good gimmick.
What are you talking about? What do you mean, gimmick?
Sure, he said, apparently missing her anger. He can make $7,000, maybe $10,000 doing a book about the accident and the coma. But if he came out of the coma psychic, the sky's the limit.
That's one hell of an allegation, Sarah said, and her voice was thin with fury.
He turned to her, his expression first one of surprise, and then of understanding. The understanding look made her angrier than ever. If she had a nickel for every time Walt Hazlitt had thought he understood her, they could fly first class to Jamaica. Look, I'm sorry I brought it up, he said.
Johnny would no more lie than the Pope would, you know.
He bellowed laughter, and in that moment she nearly picked up his own coffee cup and threw it at him. Instead, she locked her hands together tightly under the table and squeezed them. Denny goggled at his father and then burst into his own peal of laughter. Honey, Walt said, I have nothing against him. I have nothing against what he's doing. In fact, I respect him for it. If that fat old mossback Fisher can go from a broke lawyer to a millionaire during 15 years in the House of Representatives, then this guy should have a perfect right to pick up as much as he can playing psychic.
Johnny doesn't lie, she repeated tonelessly.
It's a gimmick for the Blue Rinse Brigade, who read the weekly tabloids and belong to the Universe Book Club, he said cheerily. Although I will admit that a little second sight would come in handy during jury selection in this damn Timmins trial.
Johnny Smith doesn't lie, she repeated, and heard him saying, It slipped off your finger. You were putting his shaving stuff into one of those side pockets, and it just slipped off. You go up in the attic and look, Sarah. You'll see.
But she couldn't tell Walt that,
Walt didn't know she had been to see Johnny. Nothing wrong in going to see him, her mind offered uneasily. No, but how would he react to the news that she had thrown her original wedding ring into the toilet and flushed it away? He might not understand the sudden twitch of fear that had made her do it, the same fear she saw mirrored on those other newsprint faces, and to some degree on Johnny's own. No, Walt might not understand that at all. After all, throwing your wedding ring into the toilet and then pushing the flush did suggest a certain vulgar symbolism. All right, Walt was saying. He doesn't lie. But I just don't believe, Sarah said softly. Look at the people behind him, Walt. Look at their faces. They believe. Walt gave them a cursory glance. Sure, the way a kid believes in a magician as long as the trick is ongoing. You think this fellow Dussault was a, what do you call it, a shill? According to the article, he and Johnny had never met before. That's the only way the illusion will work, Sarah, Walt said patiently. It doesn't do a magician any good to pull a bunny out of a rabbit hutch, only out of a hat. Either Johnny Smith knew something, or he made a terribly good guess based on this guy Dussault's behavior at the time. But I repeat, I respect him for it. He got a lot of mileage out of it. If it turns him a buck, more power to him. In that moment, she hated him, loathed him, this good man she had married. There was really nothing so terrible on the reverse side of his goodness, his steadiness, his mild good humor, just the belief, apparently grounded in the bedrock of his soul, that everybody was looking out for number one, each with his or her own little racket. This morning, he could call Harrison Fisher a fat old mossback. Last night, he'd been bellowing with laughter at Fisher's stories about Greg Stilson, the funny mayor of some town or other, and who might just be crazy enough to run as an independent in the House race next year. No, in the world of Walt Hazlitt, no one had psychic powers, and there were no heroes, and the doctrine of, we have to change the system from within, was all-powerful. He was a good man, a steady man. He loved her and Denny. But suddenly her soul cried out for Johnny and the 5 years together of which they had been robbed, or the lifetime together. A child with darker hair. You better get going, babe, she said quietly. He'll have your guy Timmons in stocks and bonds, or whatever they are. Sure, he smiled at her. The summation done, session adjourned. Still friends? Still friends. But he knew where the ring was. He knew. Walt kissed her, his right hand resting lightly on the back of her neck. He always had the same thing for breakfast. He always kissed her the same way. Someday they were going to Washington, and no one was psychic. 5 minutes later, he was gone, backing their little red Pinto out onto Pond Street, giving his usual brief toot on the horn and putting away. She was left alone with Denny, who was in the process of strangling himself while he tried to wiggle under his high chair tray. You're going at that all wrong, sluggo, Sarah said, crossing the kitchen and unlatching the tray. Blue, Denny said, disgusted with the whole thing. Speedy Tomato, their tomcat, sauntered into the kitchen at his usual slow, hip-shot, juvenile delinquent stride, and Denny grabbed him, making little chuckling noises. Speedy laid his ears back and looked resigned. Sarah smiled a little and cleared the table. Inertia. A body at rest tends to remain at rest, and she was at rest. Never mind Walt's darker side. She had her own. She had no intention of doing more than sending Johnny a card at Christmas. It was better, safer that way. Because a body in motion tends to keep moving. Her life here was good. She had survived Dan. She had survived Johnny, who had been so unfairly taken from her, but so much in this world was unfair. She'd come through her own personal rapids to this smooth water, and here she would stay. This sunshiny kitchen was not a bad place. Best to forget county fairs, wheels of fortune, and Johnny Smith's face. As she ran water into the sink to do the dishes, she turned on the radio and caught the beginning of the news. The first item made her freeze with a just-washed plate in one hand,
her eyes looking out over their small backyard in startled contemplation. Johnny's mother had had a stroke while watching a TV report on her son's press conference. She had died this morning, not an hour ago. Sarah dried her hands, snapped off the radio, and pried Speedy Tomato out of Denny's hands. She carried her boy into the living room and popped him into his playpen. Denny protested this indignity with loud, lusty howls of which she took no notice. She went to the telephone and called the EMMC. A switchboard operator who sounded tired of repeating the same piece of intelligence over and over again told her that John Smith had discharged himself the night before, slightly before midnight. She hung up the phone and sat down in a chair. Denny continued to cry from his playpen. Water ran into the kitchen sink. After a while, she got up, went into the kitchen, and turned it off. Chapter 14. 1. The man from Inside View showed up on October 16th, not long after Johnny had walked up to get the mail. His father's house was set well back from the road. The gravel driveway was nearly a quarter of a mile long, running through a heavy stand of second-growth spruce and pine. Johnny did the total round trip every day. At first, he had returned to the porch trembling with exhaustion, his legs on fire, his limp so pronounced that he was really lurching along. But now, a month and a half after the first time, when the half a mile had taken him an hour to do, the walk had become one of his day's pleasures, something to look forward to. Not the mail, but the walk. He'd begun splitting wood for the coming winter, a chore Herb had been planning to hire out since he himself had landed a contract to do some inside work on a new housing project in Libertyville. "You know when old age has started looking over your shoulder, John," he had said with a smile. "It's when you start looking for inside work as soon as fall rolls around." Johnny climbed the porch and sat down in the wicker chair beside the glider, uttering a small sound of relief. He propped his right foot on the porch railing and with a grimace of pain used his hands to lift his leg over it. That done, he began to open his mail. It had tapered off a lot just lately. During the first week he'd been back here in Pownall, there had sometimes been as many as 2 dozen letters and 8 or 9 packages a day, most of them forwarded through the EMMC, a few of them sent to general delivery, Pownall and assorted variant spellings, Pownell, Pownall, and, in one memorable case, Poonets. Most of them were from disassociated people who seemed to be drifting through life in search of any rudder. There were children who wanted his autograph, women who wanted to sleep with him, both men and women seeking advice to the lovelorn. Some sent lucky charms, some sent horoscopes. A great many of the letters were religious in nature, and in these badly spelled missives, usually written in a large and careful handwriting, but one step removed from the scrawl of a bright first grader, he seemed to feel the ghost of his mother. He was a prophet, these letters assured him, come to lead the weary and disillusioned American people out of the wilderness. He was a sign that the last times were at hand. To this date, October 16th, he had received 8 copies of Hal Lindsey's The Late Great Planet Earth. His mother surely would have approved of that one. He was urged to proclaim the divinity of Christ and put a stop to the loose morals of youth. These letters were balanced off by the negative contingent, which was smaller but just as vocal, if usually anonymous. One correspondent writing in grubby pencil on a sheet of yellow legal paper proclaimed him the Antichrist and urged him to commit suicide. 4 or 5 of the letter writers had inquired about how it felt to murder your own mother. A great many wrote to accuse him of perpetrating a hoax. One wit wrote, "Precognition, telepathy, bullshit. Eat my dong, you extrasensory turkey." And then they sent things. That was the worst of it. Every day on his way home from work, Herb would stop at the Pownall post office and pick up the packages that were too big to fit in their mailbox. The notes accompanying the things were all essentially the same. A low-grade scream. "Tell me, tell me, tell me. This scarf belonged to my brother, who disappeared on a fishing trip in the Allagash in 1969. I feel very strongly that he is still alive,
tell me where he is.
This lipstick came from my wife's dressing table. I think she's having an affair, but I'm not sure. Tell me if she is.
This is my son's ID bracelet. He never comes home after school anymore. He stays out until all hours. I'm worried sick. Tell me what he's doing.
A woman in North Carolina, God knew how she had found out about him. The press conference in August had not made the national media, sent a charred piece of wood. Her house had burned down, her letter explained, and her husband and two of her five children had died in the blaze. The Charlotte Fire Department said it was faulty wiring, but she simply couldn't accept that. It had to be arson. She wanted Johnny to feel the enclosed blackened relic and tell her who had done it, so the monster would spend the rest of his life rotting in prison. Johnny answered none of the letters and returned all the objects, even the charcoaled hunk of wood, at his cost and with no comment. He did touch some of them. Most, like the charred piece of wallboard from the grief-stricken woman in Charlotte, told him nothing at all. But when he touched a few of them, disquieting images came, like waking dreams. In most cases, there was barely a trace. A picture would form and fade in seconds, leaving him with nothing concrete at all, only a feeling, but one of them. It had been the woman who sent the scarf in hopes of finding out what had happened to her brother. It was a white knitted scarf, no different from a million others. But as he handled it, the reality of his father's house had suddenly been gone, and the sound of the television in the next room rose and flattened, until it was the sound of drowsing summer insects and the faraway babble of water. Wood smells in his nostrils, green shafts of sunlight falling through great old trees. The ground had been soggy for the last 3 hours or so, squelchy, almost swamp-like. He was scared, plenty scared, but he had kept his head. If you were lost in the big North Country and panicked, they might as well carve your headstone. He had kept pushing south. It had been 2 days since he had gotten separated from Stiv and Rocky and Logan. They had been camping near... But that wouldn't come. It was in the dead zone. Some stream, trout fishing, and it had been his own damn fault. He had been pretty damn drunk. Now he could see his pack leaning against the edge of an old and moss-grown blowdown, white deadwood poking through the green here and there like bones. He could see his pack, yes, but he couldn't reach it because he had walked a few yards away to take a leak, and he had walked into a really squelchy place, mud almost to the top of his L.L. Bean boots, and he had tried to back out, find a drier place to do his business, but he couldn't get out. He couldn't get out because it wasn't mud at all. It was something else. He stood there looking around fruitlessly for something to grab onto, almost laughing at the idiocy of having walked right into a patch of quicksand while looking for a place to take a piss. He stood there, at first positive that it must be a shallow patch of quicksand, at the very worst over his boot tops, another tale to tell when he was found. He stood there, and real panic did not begin to set in until the quicksand oozed implacably over his knees. He began to struggle then, forgetting that if you got your stupid self into quicksand, you were supposed to remain very still. In no time at all, the quicksand was up to his waist, and now it was chest high, sucking at him like great brown lips, constricting his breathing. He began to scream, and no one came. Nothing came except for a fat brown squirrel that picked its way down the side of the mossy deadfall and perched on his pack and watched him with his bright black eyes. Now it was up to his neck, the rich brown smell of it in his nose, and his screams became thin and gasping as the quicksand implacably pressed the breath out of him. Birds flew swooping and cheeping and scolding, and green shafts of sunlight like tarnished copper fell through the trees, and the quicksand rose over his chin. Alone. He was going to die alone. And he opened his mouth to scream one last time, and there was no scream, because the quicksand flowed into his mouth. It flowed over his tongue,
It flowed between his teeth in thin ribbons. He was swallowing quicksand, and the scream was never uttered. Johnny had come out of that in a cold sweat, his flesh marbled into goosebumps, the scarf wrapped tightly between his hands, his breath coming in short, strangled gasps. He had thrown the scarf on the floor, where it lay like a twisted white snake. He would not touch it again. His father had put it in a return envelope and sent it back. But now, mercifully, the mail was beginning to taper off. The crazies had discovered some fresher object for their public and private obsessions. Newsmen no longer called for interviews, partly because the phone number had been changed and unlisted, partly because the story was old hat. Roger Dussault had written a long and angry piece for his paper, of which he was the feature editor. He proclaimed the whole thing a cruel and tasteless hoax. Johnny had undoubtedly boned up on incidents from the past of several reporters who were likely to attend the press conference, just in case. Yes, he admitted his sister Anne's nickname had been Terry. She had died fairly young, and amphetamines might have been a contributing cause. But all of that was accessible information to anyone who wanted to dig it up. He made it all seem quite logical. The article did not explain how Johnny, who had not been out of the hospital, could have come by this accessible information, but that was a point most readers seemed to have overlooked. Johnny could not have cared less. The incident was closed, and he had no intention of creating new ones. What good could it possibly do to write the lady who had sent the scarf and tell her that her brother had drowned, screaming, in quicksand because he had gone the wrong way while looking for a place to take a piss? Would it ease her mind or help her live her life any better? Today's mail was a mere 6 letters. A power bill, a card from Herb's cousin in Oklahoma, a lady who had sent Johnny a crucifix with "Made in Taiwan" stamped on Christ's feet in tiny gold letters. There was a brief note from Sam Wyzak, and a small envelope with a return address that made him blink and sit up straighter. S. Hazlitt, 12 Pond Street, Bangor. Sarah. He tore it open. He had received a sympathy card from her 2 days after the funeral services for his mother. Written on the back of it, in her cool, backslanting hand, had been, "Johnny, I'm so sorry that this has happened. I heard on the radio that your mom had passed away. In some ways, that seems the most unfair thing of all, that your private grief should have been made a thing of public knowledge. You may not remember, but we talked a little about your mom the night of the accident. I asked you what she'd do if you brought home a lapsed Catholic, and you said she would smile and welcome me in and slip me a few tracts. I could see your love for her and the way you smiled. I know from your father that she had changed, but much of the change was because she loved you so much and just couldn't accept what had happened. And in the end, I guess her faith was rewarded. Please accept my warm sympathy, and if there's anything I can do now or later on, please count on your friend. Sarah." That was one note he had answered, thanking her for both the card and the thought. He had written it carefully, afraid that he might betray himself and say the wrong thing. She was a married woman now. That was beyond his control or ability to change. But he did remember their conversation about his mother and so many other things about that night. Her note had summoned up the whole evening, and he answered in a bittersweet mood that was more bitter than sweet. He still loved Sarah Bracknell, and he had to remind himself constantly that she was gone, replaced by another woman who was 5 years older and the mother of a small boy. Now he pulled a single sheet of stationery out of the envelope and scanned it quickly. She and her boy were headed down to Kennebunk to spend a week with Sarah's freshman and sophomore roommate, a girl named Stephanie Constantine now, Stephanie Carsley then. She said that Johnny might remember her, but Johnny didn't. Anyway, Walt was stuck in Washington for 3 weeks on combined firm and Republican Party business, and Sarah thought she might take one afternoon and come by Pownall to see Johnny and Herb, if it was no trouble. "You can reach me at Steph's number, 814-6219, any time between October 17th and the 23rd. Of course, if it would make you feel uncomfortable in any way, just call me and say so,
either up here or down there in K-Bunk. I'll understand. Much love to both of you, Sarah.
Holding the letter in one hand, Johnny looked across the yard and into the woods, which had gone russet and gold, seemingly just in the last week. The leaves would be falling soon, and then it would be time for winter.
Much love to both of you, Sarah.
He ran his thumb across the words thoughtfully. It would be better not to call, nor to write, not to do anything, he thought. She would get the message. Like the woman who mailed the scarf. What possible good could it do? Why kick a sleeping dog? Sarah might be able to use that phrase, much love, blithely, but he could not. He wasn't over the hurt of the past. For him, time had been crudely folded, stapled, and mutilated. In the progression of his own interior time, she had been his girl only 6 months ago. He could accept the coma and the loss of time in an intellectual way, but his emotions stubbornly resisted. Answering her condolence note had been difficult, but with a note, it was always possible to crumple the thing up and start again if it began to go in directions it shouldn't go, if it began to overstep the bounds of friendship, which was all they were now allowed to share. If he saw her, he might do or say something stupid. Better not to call. Better just to let it sink. But he would call, he thought. Call and invite her over. Troubled, he slipped the note back into the envelope. The sun caught on bright chrome, twinkled there, and tossed an arrow of light back into his eyes. A Ford sedan was crunching its way down the driveway. Johnny squinted and tried to make out if it was a familiar car. Company out here was rare. There had been lots of mail, but people had only stopped by on 3 or 4 occasions. Pownall was small on the map, hard to find. If the car did belong to some seeker after knowledge, Johnny would send him or her quickly away, as kindly as possible, but firmly. That had been Wyzak's parting advice. Good advice, Johnny thought.
Don't let anyone rope you into the role of consulting Swami, John. Give no encouragement, and they will forget. It may seem heartless to you at first. Most of them are misguided people with too many problems and only the best of intentions. But it is a question of your life, your privacy. So be firm. And so he had been.
The Ford pulled into the turnaround between the shed and the woodpile, and as it swung around, Johnny saw the small hurt sticker in the corner of the windshield. A very tall man, in very new blue jeans, and a red plaid hunting shirt that looked as if it had just come out of an L.L. Bean box, got out of the car, and glanced around. He had the air of a man who is not used to the country. A man who knows there are no more wolves or cougars in New England, but who wants to make sure all the same. A city man. He glanced up at the porch, saw Johnny, and raised one hand in greeting.
Good afternoon, he said.
He had a flat city accent as well. Brooklyn, Johnny thought, and he sounded as if he were talking through a saltine box.
Hi, Johnny said. Lost? Boy, I hope not, the stranger said, coming over to the foot of the steps. You're either John Smith or his twin brother.
Johnny grinned.
I don't have a brother, so I guess you found your way to the right door.
Can I do something for you?
Well, maybe we can do something for each other.
The stranger mounted the porch steps and offered his hand. Johnny shook it.
My name is Richard Dees, Inside View Magazine.
His hair was cut in a fashionable ear-length style, and it was mostly gray. Dyed gray, Johnny thought with some amusement. What could you say about a man who sounded as if he were talking through a saltine box and dyed his hair gray?
Maybe you've seen the magazine.
Oh, I've seen it. They sell it at the checkout counters in the supermarket. I'm not interested in being interviewed. Sorry you had to make a trip out here for nothing.
They sold it in the supermarket, all right. The headline did everything but leap off the pulp stock pages and try to mug you.
Child killed by creatures from space. Distraught mother cries. The foods that are poisoning your children. 12 psychics predict California earthquake by 1978.
Well now, an interview wasn't exactly what we were thinking of, Dee said. May I sit down?
Really, Mr. Smith, I've flown all the way from New York. And from Boston, I came on a little plane that had me wondering what would happen to my wife if I died intestate.
Portland Bangor Airways? Johnny asked, grinning.
That's what it was,
Deez agreed. All right, Johnny said. I'm impressed with your valor and your dedication to your job. I'll listen, but only for 15 minutes or so. I'm supposed to sleep every afternoon. This was a small lie in a good cause.
15 minutes should be more than enough.
Deez leaned forward. I'm just making an educated guess, Mr. Smith, but I'd estimate that you must owe somewhere in the neighborhood of $200,000. That rolls somewhere within putting distance of the pin, does it?
Johnny's smile thinned.
What I owe or don't owe, he said, is my business.
All right, of course, sure. I didn't mean to offend Mr. Smith. Inside View would like to offer you a job. A rather lucrative job.
No, absolutely not.
If you just give me a chance to lay this out for you,
Johnny said, I'm not a practicing psychic. I'm not a Gene Dixon or an Edgar Cayce or an Alex Tanis. That's over with. The last thing I want to do is rake it up again.
Can I just have a few moments?
Mr. Deez, you don't seem to understand what I'm-
Just a few moments, Deez smiled winningly.
How did you find out where I was anyway?
We have a stringer on a mid-main paper called the Kennebec Journal. He said that although you dropped out of the public view, you were probably staying with your father.
Well, I owe him a real debt of thanks, don't I?
Sure, Dee said easily. I'm betting you'll think so when you hear the whole deal. May I?
All right, Johnny said. But just because you flew up here on Panic Airlines, I'm not going to change my mind.
Well, however you see it, it's a free country, isn't it? Sure it is. Inside View specializes in a psychic view of things, Mr. Smith, as you probably know. Our readers, to be perfectly frank, are out of their gourds for this stuff. We have a weekly circulation of 3 million. 3 million readers every week, Mr. Smith. How's that for a long shot straight down the fairway? How do we do it? We stick with the upbeat, the spiritual.
Twin babies eaten by killer bear, Johnny murmured.
Dee shrugged.
Sure, well, it's a tough old world, isn't it? People have to be informed about these things. It's their right to know. But for every downbeat article, we've got 3 others telling our readers how to lose weight painlessly, how to find sexual happiness and compatibility, how to get closer to God.
Do you believe in God, Mr. Deez?
Actually, I don't, Deez said, and smiled his winning smile. But we live in a democracy, greatest country on earth, right? Everyone is a captain of his own soul. No, the point is our readers believe in God. They believe in angels and miracles.
And exorcisms and devils and black masses.
Right, right, right. You catch. It's a spiritual audience. They believe all this psychic bourgeois. We have a total of 10 psychics under contract, including Kathleen Nolan, the most famous seer in America. We'd like to put you under contract, Mr. Smith.
Would you?
Indeed we would. What would it mean for you? Your picture in a short column would appear roughly 12 times a year. When we run one of our all-psychic issues, Inside View's 10 famous psychics preview the second Ford administration, that sort of thing. We always do a New Year's issue and one each 4th of July on the course of America over the next year. That's always a very informative issue. Lots of chip shots on foreign policy and economic policy in that one, plus assorted other goodies.
I don't think you understand, Johnny said. He's speaking very slowly, as if to a child. I've had a couple of precognitive bursts. I suppose you could say I saw the future, but I don't have any control over it.
I could no more come up with the prediction for the second Ford administration, if there ever is one, than I could milk a bull.
Deez looked horrified.
Who said you could? Staff writers do all those columns.
Staff? Johnny gaped at Deez, finally shocked.
Of course, Deez said impatiently. Look, one of our most popular guys over the last couple of years has been Frank Ross, the guy who specializes in natural disasters. Hell of a nice guy, but Jesus Christ, he quit school in the 9th grade. He did 2 hitches in the army, and was swapping out Greyhound buses at the Port Authority terminal in New York when we found him. You think we'd let him write his own column? He'd misspell cat.
But the predictions?
A free hand. Nothing but a free hand. But you'd be surprised how often these guys and gals get stuck for a real whopper.
Whopper? Johnny repeated, bemused. He was a little surprised to find himself getting angry. His mother had bought Inside View for as long as he could remember, all the way back to the days when they had featured pictures of bloody car wrecks, decapitations, and bootlegged execution photos. She had sworn by every word, presumably the greater part of Inside View's other 2,999,999 readers did as well. And here sat this fellow with his dyed gray hair and his $40 shoes and his shirt with the store creases still in it, talking about whoppers.
But it all works out, Deez was saying. If you ever get stuck, all you have to do is call us collect, and we all take it into the pro shop together and come up with something. We have the right to anthologize your columns in our yearly book, Inside View of Things to Come. You're perfectly free to sign any contract you can get with a book publisher, however. All we get is first refusal on the magazine rights, and we hardly ever refuse, I can tell you. And we pay very handsomely. That's over and above whatever figure we contract for. Gravy on your mashed potatoes, you might say, Deez chuckled.
And what might that figure be? Johnny asked slowly. He was gripping the arms of his rocker, a vein in his right temple pulsed rhythmically.
$30,000 per year for 2 years, Deez said. And if you prove popular, that figure would become negotiable. Now, all our psychics have some area of expertise. I understand that you're good with objects. Deez's eyes became half-lidded, dreamy. I see a regular feature, twice monthly maybe. We don't want to run a good thing into the ground. John Smith invites Inside viewers to send in personal belongings for psychic examination. Something like that. We'd make it clear, of course, that they should send in inexpensive stuff because nothing could be returned. But you'd be surprised. Some people are as crazy as bedbugs, God love them. You'd be surprised at some of the stuff that would come in, diamonds, gold coins, wedding rings. And we could attach a rider in the contract specifying that all objects mailed in would become your personal property. Now Johnny began to see tones of dull red before his eyes. People would send things in and I'd just keep them. That's what you're saying.
Sure, I don't see any problem with that. It's just a question of keeping the ground rules clear up front. A little extra gravy for those mashed potatoes.
Suppose, Johnny said, carefully keeping his voice even and modulated. Suppose I got stuck for a whopper, as you put it, and I just called in and said President Ford was going to be assassinated on September 31st, 1976. Not because I felt he was, but because I was stuck.
Well, September only has 30 days, you know, Deez said. But otherwise, I think it's a hole in one. You're going to be a natural, Johnny. You think big. That's good. You'd be surprised how many of these people think small, afraid to put their mouths where the money is, I suppose. One of our guys, Tim Clark, out in Idaho, wrote in 2 weeks ago and said he'd had a flash that Earl Butts was going to be forced to resign next year. Well, pardon my French, but who gives a fuck? Who's Earl Butts to the American housewife? But you have good waves, Johnny. You were made for this stuff.
Good waves, Johnny muttered. Deez was looking at him curiously.
You feel all right, Johnny? You look a little white.
Johnny was thinking of the lady who had sent the scarf. Probably she read Inside View, too. Let me see if I can summarize this, he said. You'd pay me $30,000 a year for my name.
And your picture, don't forget.
And my picture. For a few ghost-written columns. Also a feature where I tell people what they want to know about objects they send in. As an extra added attraction, I get to keep the stuff.
If the lawyers can work it out.
As my personal property. That the deal?
That's the bare bones of the deal, Johnny. The way these things feed each other, it's just amazing. You'll be a household word in 6 months, and after that, the sky's the limit. The Carson Show, personal appearances, lecture tours, your book, of course, pick your house,
They're practically throwing money at psychics along Publishers Row. Kathy Nolan started with a contract like the one we're offering you, and she makes over $200,000 a year now. Also, she founded her own church, and the IRS can't touch dime one of her money. She doesn't miss a trick, does our Kathy?
Deez leaned forward, grinning. I tell you, Johnny, the sky is the limit.
I'll bet.
Well, what do you think?
Johnny leaned forward toward Deez. He grabbed the sleeve of Deez's new L.L. Bean shirt in one hand and the collar of Deez's new L.L. Bean shirt in the other.
Hey, what the hell do you think you'd do?
Johnny bunched the shirt in both hands and drew Deez forward. 5 months of daily exercise had toned up the muscles in his hands and arms to a formidable degree.
You asked me what I thought, Johnny said. His head was beginning to throb and ache.
I'll tell you. I think you're a ghoul, a grave robber of people's dreams. I think somebody ought to put you to work at Roto-Rooter. I think your mother should have died of cancer the day after she conceived you. If there's a hell, I hope you burn there.
You can't talk to me like that, Deez cried. His voice rose to a fishwife's shriek. You're fucking crazy. Forget it. Forget the whole thing, you stupid hick son of a bitch. You had your chance. Don't come crawling around.
Furthermore, you sound like you're talking through a saltine box, Johnny said, standing up. He lifted Deez with him. The tails of his shirt popped out of the waistband of his new jeans, revealing a fishnet undershirt underneath. Johnny began to shake Deez methodically back and forth. Deez forgot about being angry. He began to blubber and roar. Johnny dragged him to the porch steps, raised one foot, and planted it squarely in the seat of the new Levi's. Deez went down in two big steps, still blubbering and roaring. He fell in the dirt and sprawled full length. When he got up and turned around to face Johnny, his country cousin duds were caked with dooryard dust. It made them look more real somehow, Johnny thought, but doubted if Deez would appreciate that.
I'd have put the cops on you, he said hoarsely, and maybe I will.
You do whatever turns you on, Johnny said. But the law around here doesn't take too kindly to people who stick their noses in where they haven't been invited.
Dee's face worked in an uneasy contortion of fear, anger, and shock.
God help you if you ever need us, he said.
Johnny's head was aching fiercely now, but he kept his voice even.
That's all right, he said. I couldn't agree more.
You're gonna be sorry, you know. 3 million readers. That cuts both ways. When we get done with you, the people in this country wouldn't believe you if you predicted spring in April. They wouldn't believe you if you said the World Series is gonna come in October. They wouldn't believe you if...
Deez spluttered, furious.
Get out of here, you cheap cocksucker, Johnny said.
You can kiss off that book, Deez screamed, apparently summoning up the worst thing he could think of.
With his working knotted face and his dust-caked shirt, he looked like a kid having a Class A tantrum. His Brooklyn accent had deepened and darkened to the point where it was almost a patois.
They'll laugh you out of every publishing house in New York. Nightstand readers wouldn't touch you when I get done with you. There are ways of fixing smart guys like you when we got them, fuckhead.
I guess I'll go get my Remy and shoot myself a trespasser, Johnny remarked.
Deez retreated to his rental car, still shouting threats and obscenities. Johnny stood on the porch and watched him, his head thudding sickly. Deez got in, revved the car's engine mercilessly, and then screamed out, throwing dirt into the air in clouds.
He let the car drift just enough on his way out to knock the chopping block by the shed flying. Johnny grinned a little at that in spite of his bad head. He could set up the chopping block a lot more easily than Deez was going to be able to explain the big dent in that Ford's front fender to the Hertz people. Afternoon sun twinkled on chrome again as Deez sprayed gravel all the way up the driveway to the road. Johnny sat down in the rocker again and put his forehead in his hand and got ready to wait out the headache.
2. You're going to do what? The banker asked. Outside and below, traffic passed back and forth along the bucolic main street of Ridgeway, New Hampshire. On the walls of the banker's pine-paneled third-floor office were Frederick Remington prints and photographs of the banker at local functions. On his desk
was a lucite cube, and embedded in this cube were pictures of his wife and his son.
"I'm going to run for the House of Representatives next year," Greg Stilson repeated. He was dressed in khaki suntan pants, a blue shirt with the sleeves rolled up, and a black tie with a single blue figure. He looked out of place in the banker's office somehow, as if at any moment he might rise to his feet and begin an aimless, destructive charge around the room, knocking over furniture, sweeping the expensively framed Remington prints to the floor, pulling the drapes from their rods. The banker, Charles Chuck Gendron, president of the local Lions Club, laughed, a bit uncertainly. Stilson had a way of making people feel uncertain. As a boy, he had been scrawny, perhaps. He liked to tell people that a high wind would have blown me away. But in the end, his father's genes had told, and sitting here in Gendron's office, he looked very much like the Oklahoma oil-filled roughneck that his father had been. He frowned at Gendron's chuckle.
"I mean, George Harvey might have something to say about that, mightn't he, Greg?" George Harvey, besides being a mover and a shaker in town politics, was the 3rd District Republican godfather.
"George won't say boo," Greg said calmly.
There was a salting of gray in his hair, but his face suddenly looked very much like the face of a man who long ago had kicked a dog to death in an Iowa farmyard. His voice was patient. "George is going to be on the sidelines, but he's going to be on my side of the sidelines, if you get my meaning. I ain't going to be stepping on his toes because I'm going to run as an independent. I don't have 20 years to spend learning the ropes and licking boots."
Chuck Gendron said hesitantly, "You're kidding me, aren't you, Greg?"
Greg's frown returned. It was forbidding.
"Chuck, I never kid. People, they think I kid. The union leader and those yo-yos on the Daily Democrat, they think I kid. But you go see George Harvey. You ask him if I kid around or if I get the job done. You ought to know better, too. After all, we buried some bodies together, didn't we, Chuck?"
The frown metamorphosed into a somehow chilling grin. Chilling to Gendron, perhaps, because he had allowed himself to be pulled along on a couple of Greg Stilson's development schemes. They had made money, yes, of course they had. That wasn't the problem. But there had been a couple of aspects of the Sunningdale Acres development, and the Laurel Estates deal as well, to be honest, that hadn't been, well, strictly legal. A bribed EPA agent, for one thing. But that wasn't the worst thing. On the Laurel Estates thing, there had been an old man out on the back Ridgeway Road who hadn't wanted to sell. And first, the old man's 14 or so chickens had died of some mysterious ailment. And second, there had been a fire in the old man's potato house. And third, when the old man came back from visiting his sister, who was at a nursing home in Keene, one weekend not so long ago, someone had smeared dog shit all over the old man's living room and dining room. And fourth, the old man had sold. And fifth, Laurel Estates was now a fact of life. And maybe sixth, that motorcycle spook Sonny Elliman was hanging around again. He and Greg were good buddies, and the only thing that kept that from being town gossip was the counterbalancing fact that Greg was seen in the company of a lot of heads, hippies, freaks, and cyclists, as a direct result of the drug counseling center he had set up. Plus, Ridgeway's rather unusual program for young drug, alcohol, and road offenders. Instead of fining them or locking them up, the town took out their services in trade. It had been Greg's idea, and a good one, the banker would be the first to admit. It had been one of the things that had helped Greg to get elected mayor. But this was utter craziness. Greg had said something else. Gendron wasn't sure what.
"Pardon me," he said.
"I asked you how you'd like to be my campaign manager," Greg repeated.
Greg?
Gendron had to clear his throat and start again. "Greg, you don't seem to understand. Harrison Fisher is the 3rd District Representative in Washington. Harrison Fisher is Republican, respected, and probably eternal."
"No one is eternal," Greg said. Harrison is damn close, Gendron said. Ask Harvey. They went to school together. Back around 1800, I think.
Greg took no notice of this witticism.
I'll call myself a bull moose or something, and everyone will think I'm kidding around. And in the end, the good people of the 3rd District are gonna laugh me all the way to Washington.
Greg, you're crazy. Greg's smile disappeared as if it had never been there. Something frightening happened to his face. It became very still, and his eyes widened to show too much of the whites. They were like the eyes of a horse that smells bad water. You don't want to say something like that, Chuck. Ever.
The banker felt more than chilled now.
Greg, I apologize. It's just that,
no, you don't ever want to say that to me. Unless you want to find Sonny Elliman waiting for you some afternoon when you go out to get your big fucking imperial.
Gendron's mouth moved, but no sound came out.
Greg smiled again, and it was like the sun suddenly breaking through threatening clouds.
Never mind. We don't want to be kicking sand if we're going to be working together.
Greg, I want you because you know every damn businessman in this part of New Hampshire. We're going to have plenty good money once we get this thing rolling, but I figure we'll have to prime the pump. Now's the time for me to expand a little and start looking like the state's man as well as Ridgeway's man. I figure $50,000 ought to be enough to fertilize the grassroots.
The banker, who had worked for Harrison Fisher in his last 4 canvasses, was so astounded by Greg's political naivete that at first he was at a loss on how to proceed. At last he said,
Greg, businessmen contribute to campaigns not out of the goodness of their hearts, but because the winner ends up owing them something. In a close campaign, they'll contribute to any candidate who has a chance of winning, because they can write off the loser as a tax loss as well. But the operant phrase is chance of winning.
Now Fisher is a shoo-in, Greg supplied. He produced an envelope from his back pocket.
Want you to look at these.
Gendron looked doubtfully at the envelope, then up at Greg. Greg nodded encouragingly. The banker opened the envelope. There was a long silence in the pine-paneled office after Gendron's initial harsh gasp for breath. It was unbroken except for the faint hum of the digital clock on the banker's desk and the hiss of a match as Greg lit a Phillies cheroot. On the walls of the office were Frederick Remington pictures. In the lucite cube were family pictures. Now, spread on the desk were pictures of the banker, with his head buried between the thighs of a young woman with black hair. Or, it might have been red. The pictures were high-grain black-and-white glossies, and it was hard to tell. The woman's face was very clear. It was not the face of the banker's wife. Some of the residents of Ridgeway would have recognized it as the face of one of the waitresses at Bobby Strang's truck stop 2 towns over. The pictures of the banker with his head between the legs of the waitress were the safe ones. Her face was clear, but his was not. In others, his own grandmother would have recognized him. There were pictures of Gendron and the waitress involved in a whole medley of sexual delights. Hardly all the positions of the Kama Sutra, but there were several positions represented that had never made the sexual relationships chapter of the Ridgeway High Health textbook. Gendron looked up, his face cheesy, his hands trembling. His heart was galloping in his chest. He feared a heart attack. Greg was not even looking at him. He was looking out the window at the bright blue slice of October sky, visible between the Ridgeway 5 and 10 and the Ridgeway Card and Notion shop.
The winds of change have started to blow, he said, and his face was distant and preoccupied, almost mystical.
He looked back at Gendron.
One of those drug freaks down at the center. Know what he gave me?
Chuck Gendron shook his head numbly. With one of his shaking hands, he was massaging the left side of his chest, just in case. His eyes kept falling to the photographs, the damning photographs. What if his secretary came in right now? He stopped massaging his chest and began gathering up the pictures, stuffing them back in the envelope.
He gave me Chairman Mao's little red book, Greg said.
A chuckle rumbled up from the barrel chest that had once been so thin, part of a body that had mostly disgusted his idolized father. And one of the proverbs in there, I can't remember exactly how it went, but it was something like, "The man who senses the wind of change should build not a windbreak, but a windmill." That was the flavor of it, anyway. He leaned forward. "Harrison Fisher's not a shoe-in. He's a has-been. Ford is a has-been. Muskie's a has-been. Humphrey's a has-been. A lot of local and state politicians all the way across this country are gonna wake up the day after Election Day and find out that they're as dead as dodo birds. They forced Nixon out, and the next year they forced out the people who stood behind him in the impeachment hearings. And next year, they'll force out Jerry Ford for the same reason." Greg Stilson's eyes blazed at the banker.
"You want to see the wave of the future? Look up in Maine at this guy Longley. The Republicans ran a guy named Irwin, and the Demos ran a guy named Mitchell, and when they counted the votes for governor, they both got a big surprise, because the people went and elected themselves an insurance man from Lewiston that didn't want any part of either party. Now they're talking about him as a dark horse candidate for president." Gendron still couldn't talk. Greg drew in his breath.
"They're all gonna think I'm kidding, see? They thought Longley was kidding, but I'm not kidding. I'm building windmills, and you're gonna supply the building materials."
He ceased. Silence fell in the office except for the hum of the clock. At last Gendron whispered, "Where did you get these pictures? Was it that Elliman?"
"Oh, hey, you don't want to talk about that. You forget all about those pictures. Keep them."
"And who keeps the negatives?"
"Chuck," Greg said earnestly, "you don't understand. I'm offering you Washington. Sky's the limit, boy. I'm not even asking you to raise that much money. Like I said, just a bucket of water to help prime the pump. When we get rolling, plenty of money's gonna come in. Now, you know the guys that have money. You have lunch with them down at the Caswell House. You play poker with them. You have written them commercial loans tied to the prime rate at no more than their say-so. And you know how to put an arm lock on them."
"Greg, you don't understand, you don't..."
Greg stood up. "The way I just put an arm lock on you," he said. The banker looked up at him. His eyes rolled helplessly. Greg Stilson thought he looked like a sheep that had been led neatly to the slaughter. $50,000, he said. "You find it." He walked out, closing the door gently behind him. Gendron heard his booming voice, even through the thick walls, bandying with his secretary. His secretary was a 60-year-old flat-chested biddy, and Stilson probably had her giggling like a schoolgirl. He was a buffoon. It was that, as much as his programs for coping with youthful crime, that had made him mayor of Ridgeway. But the people didn't elect buffoons to Washington. Well, hardly ever. That wasn't his problem. $50,000 in campaign contributions, that was his problem. His mind began to scurry around the problem like a trained white rat scurrying around a piece of cheese on a plate. It could probably be done. Yes, it could probably be done. But would it end there? The white envelope was still on his desk. His smiling wife looked at it from her place in the Lucite cube. He scooped the envelope up and jammed it into the inner pocket of his suit coat. It had been Elliman. Somehow, Elliman had found out and had taken the pictures. He was sure of it. But it had been Stilson who told him what to do. Maybe the man wasn't such a buffoon after all. His assessment of the political climate of 1975 to 76 wasn't completely stupid. "Building windmills instead of windbreaks. The sky's the limit." But that wasn't his problem. $50,000 was his problem. Chuck Gendron, president of the Lions and all-around good fellow. Last year, he had ridden one of those small, funny motorcycles in the Ridgeway 4th of July parade.
pulled a yellow legal tablet out of the top drawer of his desk and began jotting down a list of names. The trained white rat at work. And down on Main Street, Greg Stilson turned his face up into the strong autumn sunlight and congratulated himself on a job well done, or well begun. Chapter 15. 1. Later, Johnny supposed that the reason he ended up finally making love to Sarah, almost 5 years to the day after the fair, had a lot to do with the visit of Richard Dees, the man from Inside View. The reason he finally weakened and called Sarah and invited her to come and visit was little more than a wistful urge to have someone nice come to call and take the nasty taste out of his mouth. Or so he told himself. He called her in Kennebunk and got the former roommate who said Sarah would be right with him. The phone clunked down, and there was a moment of silence when he contemplated, but not very seriously, just hanging up and closing the books for good. Then Sarah's voice was in his ear. Johnny, is it you?
The very same.
How are you?
Fine. How's by you?
I'm fine, she said. Glad you called. I didn't know if you would.
Still sniffing that wicked cocaine?
No, I'm on heroin now.
You got your boy with you?
I sure do. Don't go anywhere without him.
Well, why don't the two of you truck out here someday before you have to go back up north?
I'd like that, Johnny, she said warmly.
Dad's working in Westbrook, and I'm chief cook and bottle washer. He gets home around 4:30, and we eat around 5:30. You're welcome to stay for dinner, but be warned. All my best dishes use Franco-American spaghetti as their base. She giggled.
Invitation accepted. Which day is best?
What about tomorrow or the day after, Sarah?
Tomorrow's fine, she said, after the briefest of hesitations. See you then.
Take care, Sarah.
You too.
He hung up thoughtfully, feeling both excited and guilty, for no good reason at all. But your mind went where it wanted to, didn't it? And where his mind wanted to go now was to examine possibilities maybe best left unconsidered.
Well, she knows the things she needs to know. She knows what time Dad comes home. What else does she need to know? And his mind answered itself.
What you gonna do if she shows up at noon?
Nothing, he answered,
and didn't wholly believe it. Just thinking about Sarah, the set of her lips, the small upward tilt of her green eyes, those were enough to make him feel weak and sappy and a little desperate. Johnny went out to the kitchen and slowly began to put together this night's supper, not so important, just for two. Father and son batching it. It hadn't been all that bad. He was still healing. He and his father had talked about the 4.5 years he had missed, about his mother, working around that carefully but always seeming to come a little closer to the center in a tightening spiral. Not needing to understand, maybe, but needing to come to terms. No, it hadn't been that bad. It was a way to finish putting things together, for both of them. But it would be over in January when he returned to Cleves Mills to teach. He'd gotten his half-year contract from Dave Pelson the week before, had signed it and sent it back. What would his father do then? Go on, Johnny supposed. People had a way of doing that, just going on, pushing through with no particular drama, no big drumrolls. He would get down to visit Herb as often as he could, every weekend, if that felt like the right thing to do. So many things had gotten strange so fast that all he could do was feel his way slowly along, groping like a blind man in an unfamiliar room. He put the roast in the oven, went into the living room, snapped on the TV, then snapped it off again. He sat down and thought about Sarah. The baby, he thought. The baby will be our chaperone if she comes early. So that was all right after all. All bases covered. But his thoughts were still long and uneasily speculative. 2. She came at 12:15 the next day, wheeling a snappy little red Pinto into the driveway and parking it, getting out, looking tall and beautiful,
her dark blonde hair caught in the mild October wind. "Hi, Johnny," she called, raising her hand. "Sarah," he came down to meet her. She lifted her face and he kissed her cheek lightly. "Just let me get the Emperor," she said, opening the passenger door. "Can I help?" "No, we get along just fine together, don't we, Denny? Come on, kiddo." Moving deftly, she unbuckled the straps holding a pudgy little baby in the car seat. She lifted him out. Denny stared around the yard with wild, solemn interest, and then his eyes fixed on Johnny and held there. He smiled. "Vig," Denny said, and waved both hands. "I think he wants to go to you," Sarah said. "Very unusual. Denny has his father's Republican sensibilities. He's rather standoffish. Want to hold him?" "Sure," Johnny said, a little doubtfully. Sarah grinned. "He won't break and you won't drop him," she said, and handed Denny over. "If you did, he'd probably bounce right up like silly putty. Disgustingly fat baby." "Vum bunk," Denny said, curling one arm nonchalantly around Johnny's neck and looking comfortably at his mother. "It's really amazing," Sarah said. "He never takes to people like... Johnny?" "Johnny." When the baby put his arm around Johnny's neck, a confused rush of feelings had washed over him like mild, warm water. There was nothing dark, nothing troubling. Everything was very simple. There was no concept of the future in the baby's thoughts, no feeling of trouble, no sense of past unhappiness, and no words, only strong images. Warmth, dryness, the mother, the man that was himself. "Johnny?" She was looking at him apprehensively. "Is everything all right?" "She's asking me about Denny," he realized. "Is everything all right with Denny? Do you see trouble? Problems?" "Everything's fine," he said. "We can go inside if you want, but I usually roost on the porch. It'll be time to crouch around the stove all day long soon enough." "I think the porch will be super. And Denny looks as if he'd like to try out the yard." "Great yard," he says. "Right, kiddo?" She ruffled his hair, and Denny laughed.